So welcome. Let's just start with a relaxation, developing a strong motivation, and then if you're happy to do so, some prayers just to set the scene, and then we'll start the teaching proper. So if you can please get yourself into a comfortable position. We begin by drawing the mind inward, paying attention to how your whole body is reacting to each in-breath and out-breath. How the whole body is reacting to each in-breath and out-breath. Gently scanning the body, simply identifying any areas of tension, doing nothing about it, simply identifying, and continue with the scan. And then, without any effort on your part, without altering your respirations in any way, simply notice that on each out-breath, the tension that you've spotted gently leaves the body naturally on each out-breath. And begin to notice the result of this type of relaxation. Even your scalp has relaxed, generating waves of relaxation, which gently cascade down the body, through the body, and wherever they touch, all tension is eased, all relaxation deepens. Noticing how smooth your forehead, how relaxed all the facial muscles, how spacious the area around the eyes and between the eyes. The gentling of the mouth, the relaxation of the jaw. And it's as if your shoulders have given up a burden and have dropped to a much more comfortable position. Shift your focus now to the rise and fall of the abdomen with the breath. And again, without any effort, without any change in your respiration, simply note that with each in-breath, your mind is becoming sharp. With each in-breath, your mind becoming bright, clear. And it's with a relaxed body and a sharp, clear mind that you set your motivation for today. Decide on your motivation, bring it to the front of your mind, and then simply and gently focus on that. Prayers are very helpful to set a motivation. And so if you're happy to do so, we shall do the prayers. If that's not what you want to do, then stay with gently focusing on your motivation. For those of you who know the refuge prayer, good, we join in. For those of you who are not too sure, then please just keep that motivation to the front and center, the motivation you generated. Just focus on that. Sangye chodam soke chunam la, janju bardu dagni kyapsu chi, dagi jin soke pe sonam ki, rola pencher sangye drukpar shu. Sangye chodam soke chunam la, janju bardu dagni kyapsu chi, dagi jin soke pe sonam ki, drola pencher sangye drukpar shu. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. Thank you. So I'm delighted to see everybody here. Welcome. Welcome. As you know, over these next 7 days, we're going to explore shamatha, highlighting essential information and essential practice, meditation skills, that we need to develop shamatha. That's really what we're aiming for. So housekeeping first, I'm sure you all have either downloaded or are aware of the timetable. Yeah, you got the timetable in front of you? So if I go through that, well done. If we go through that, any questions you just ask, okay? So we're looking at a timetable that starts today and ends on Friday the 22nd at 4 p.m. Today and tomorrow, the sessions will be 10 o'clock in the morning to midday, then 2 o'clock to 4 o'clock. Okay, straightforward. That's today and Sunday. Now, for the next 3 days, slightly different. On Monday the 18th, there'll be the morning is free for you to do personal practice. I will be teaching on Monday from 2 to 4 p.m. On Tuesday the 19th, I will be teaching from 10 o'clock to 12 o'clock. And that afternoon will be time for you to do personal practice. Wednesday the 20th, the morning is yours to do personal practice. And I will be teaching from 2 to 4. The next 2 days, Thursday and Friday, you're stuck with me the whole day. 10 to 12 and 2 to 4. Okay. Now, for those of you who are used to retreating on your own or have practiced shamatha before, then you'll be fine to just continue with what you're used to. But I will be giving some advice for those who are not too sure What I would suggest that you do during your personal practice, okay? So you won't be left hanging in the air. And I know you'll be up, you know, 7 o'clock in the morning and various things, so I'll give you plenty to do if you wish. Okay. The sessions that I'll be teaching, there'll be a variety of ways of learning. So there will be teaching, of course. There'll be some discussion. There will be question and answer, and above all, meditation. So there's going to be a combination of all of this. Now, it's clear, as with any teaching, that if you want full benefit for this course of teaching, then it's good if you can attend all the sessions. However, every individual session that we do on its own will definitely benefit your ordinary practice, your ordinary Dharma practice. Each individual session, it's so precious, these shamatha teachings. It's good if we can start promptly, but I do understand that with these days, you have so much on, so much to do. So if you have to start later, if you have to leave earlier, please do so. Don't worry about me or, you know, just do what you need to do, okay? You don't have to let me know, not at all. Simply come when you can and leave when you can. If you can remain for the whole time, that's fine. But please don't worry if you're late. This worries me more than anything. If people are a wee bit late, sometimes they don't want to log on because they're embarrassed. Don't be embarrassed. Just log in when you can, okay? So any questions about the timetable? Everybody's happy about that. That's okay. So could I ask, I mean, I'm seeing quite a few people that I know have had many teachings on shamatha and have practiced it for some time. So can you indicate if shamatha is either brand new to you or relatively new? Could you just indicate with your hands if it's relatively new to you or completely new to you? Okay, that's fine. So the thing to remember about these teachings is, although I've highly recommended it, because this is where the structure comes from, the Attention Revolution by Lama Alan Wallace, I'm not teaching the book. That would take far too long. I'm not teaching the book, but I am using it as a structure. I am using the quotes, and most of all, I'm using the teachings from there. So there'll be some things that you read in the book that I won't be teaching. That's just the way it has to be, okay? Because what I'm really doing, I'm highlighting the essential information that we really need in order to practice shamatha meditation effectively. The essential information, not just to practice effectively, but to gain confidence in your practice. Later on, after this course, I would encourage you to go forward to deepen your practice, give your practice more context and texture. There's some very good shamatha teachers. And towards the end of this course, I should again highly recommend, if you can possibly get teachings from Lama Alan Wallace or Glenn Svensson, these two people in particular, absolutely, in my opinion, perfect teachers on shamatha. Also, it would complement this course. Okay. All right. So with shamatha, there are a variety. If you've ever tried to find out about shamatha, you will notice there are a variety of teachers. There are a variety of different and very valid techniques of shamatha. The overall aim of all of these is really to develop skill in shamatha. Where do the differences come from? Well, the differences tend to tailor around your chosen object of concentration. So there'll be different teachings if you are using a visualized object or an object of the mind. This would be different. Some differences occur with depending which path the person is on. Because this is very useful in a secular life, if someone's teaching a secular path, the teachings might be slightly different. If your path is Theravadin, there might be slight differences in a Theravadin approach. there might be slight differences in a Mahayana approach, a tantric approach, or a Dzogchen approach. So you need to know that, because some people think they can pick up a book on shamatha and just continue on, and then they get worried about the differences. But what we are doing here will give you the skill and confidence to practice shamatha, whatever object you choose. Okay. Now, I suppose the main difference in objects, when people choosing objects of concentration, is either objects with a sign or objects without a sign. I'll go into that deeper, but basically you're looking at something to visualize, something to focus on. And then you're looking at objects that really are more on the mind itself. Certainly with the Galukha and Sakya approach, if you're reading texts on Galukha and Sakya, they tend to emphasize visualization strongly. If you're reading shamatha techniques that are by the Nyingma or the Kagyu, they strongly emphasize mind itself. These teachings we're doing are based on Lama Alan Wallace's book, Attention Revolution, which highlights three objects. It highlights using the object of the breath. It highlights using the object of the mind itself and its contents. And by that, I mean mind and mental events. And the third object that, not really called object, but still, the third focus is awareness itself. Now, we can have confidence in these three because although the different schools have preferences, these three, breath, mind and its contents, and awareness, is deeply rooted in all four schools of Tibetan Buddhism. All four schools of Tibetan Buddhism. Highly recommended also by His Holiness the Dalai Lama. Now, I teach this because I tried for years, with a lot of frustration, to develop shamatha based on visualization. My visualization skills were not too bad at the beginning, and steadily got worse. And so I couldn't progress, really, with shamatha until I had some teachings by Lama Alan Wallace with these three objects. So I teach this not because I think it's the best all around, but because it's highly I found it highly beneficial for myself. And if I find it highly beneficial, then I have confidence to teach someone else. Okay. So what is shamatha? Well, there are many different definitions of shamatha. Lama Alan Wallace says it's the path of attentional development. It's the path of attentional development that accumulates in being able to hold attention on a particular chosen object for hours on end. Simple. The ability to do that, to develop these attention skills, is extremely valuable from a secular point of view. For every activity of daily living that we attend to, the ability to focus really tells you if you're going to be successful in what you're focusing on. The ability to focus. We know from our own life, if we pay good attention to something, the outcomes are quite good. If our attention is poor, the outcome is really not so good. So whatever task, whether it's professional, whether it's social, and whether it's religious, whether it's world peace, all of them require some sort of highly developed ability to focus. It's a simple fact. You just need that. All contemplative religions, all contemplative way of lives, it's almost a hidden message in all of them that you need to be able to focus. The power of concentration, the power of being able to focus your attention, is in all traditions, religious and non-tradition. So what's the problem? Well, if you've ever tried to focus on the breath for any length of time, you'll know exactly what the problem is. But let's structure it. The problem basically is the untrained mind. The untrained mind oscillates, moves constantly from agitation to dullness, like this. Agitation to dullness. Now, when we say agitation, you can put in the word excitation. What's another good word? Excitation, disruption of any sort. It's a mental energy that's taking you away from the object. So this sort of excitation, agitation, it means the same thing. It means there's a lot of energy going on that's pulling you away from what you want to do. Very restless mind. So it's oscillating that way. And it's also oscillating to dullness. Sometimes some of the texts say sleepiness, but I don't think it's quite sleepiness. It's not as if you're going to drop off to sleep, although we do sometimes. But it's that dull, lackluster that you kind of get when you're bored. You know, you're losing the object, but you're not losing the object because of restlessness. You're losing the object because of dullness. If we can't balance that, then there is no real hope of delving deep into the human psyche. There's no real hope of really delving deep into consciousness. Okay? Agitation and dullness prevents all of that. And all of Dharma, really, is really about discovering consciousness. Discovering what is real, what is not real. To do that, the power of attention is absolutely vital, absolutely vital. Now, when I first was interested in shamatha many years ago, there was very little teaching. I find it quite difficult to find people who would teach me shamatha or would put any emphasis on it. And yet it's there in the Lam Rim, in the Great Scope. And it seems Lama Alan often gives a talk saying there's very little emphasis now on developing sustained attention. Sustained attention that can be sustained for hours on end. It's not really emphasized in many of the modern Vipassana movements. It's not really emphasized in modern Theravadan teachings. Within the early Chinese school, there was, but Lama Alan says even in modern Zen practices, there's very little emphasis on developing shamatha. In the Tibetan tradition, there is a lot of emphasis in the texts on developing shamatha. There are detailed instructions on how to develop. You have testimonies and commentaries by many yogis, many teachers, many adepts in how to do it. So it seems as if it's been kept alive within the Tibetan. Although, as His Holiness the Dalai Lama often says, not many Tibetans really practicing this. And yet shamatha is absolutely fundamental for any advanced meditation to be effective. It's fundamental. The key to mental balance, it's really fundamental. So where is this thing coming from? It's fundamental, but people don't tend to do it. What we're talking about here? Well, historically, the 600s onwards until now, there has been this ongoing debate between the benefit of developing attentional balance, developing it, and this kind of sudden insight, realization, these flashes of understanding. And many people came down on the side of flashes of single-pointed concentration is enough. It's all you really need in order to penetrate the nature of reality. And this was going on in Tibet way back in 793. So what was happening there, King Trizon Detsen, you can find this out, but basically he really was worried because you had the traditional teachings from Padmasambhava, which said you have to have attentional development developed in a particular way in order to have the sustained focus of attention. And you had another school which was very popular in Tibet, led by someone called a monk called Hashan Moyen. And he came from the Chinese Chan school, and he was saying, you don't need this. All you need is kind of flashes of insight. You don't really need to spend time developing this. And so what the king did is he organized a huge debate in Tibet. And these debates weren't your nice debates you see on television now. These were serious. So you had Hashang with all his supporters and all his texts. You had one of the most foremost monk scholars of the time called Kamala Shila, who represented the Nalanda approach to Shamatha. And they had the debate. This debate, depending on which text you read, lasted months. Each had their supporters. But in the end, Kamala Shila won the debate. And what did he win? He won the idea that in order to penetrate the nature of reality, you need to have a sustained, developed attention. And you develop that through a basis of ethics. On the basis of ethics, developing concentration. On the basis of that, developing wisdom. He won the debate. He said, flashes of insight, this momentary realization, is very, very important, very valuable, but it's not sustainable. It's not, you lose it very quickly. If you want a sustained approach, then you need to have ethics, develop your attention, and that way you have access to wisdom. Now, when you lost a debate in India or in Tibet, then the loser was banished from the country. And that's what happened to Hashan. He was banished from Tibet, and all his texts were burned. Yeah. And so what prevailed within Tibet from that time onwards was really this developmental approach to shamatha. First, as Lama says, sharpen the mind of attentional development, sharpen it, and then you've got a tool that you can direct towards anything and achieve whatever you set out to achieve. This idea, even in the 19th, 20th, and 21st century, is also examined by psychologists all the time. And you'll notice if you read Alan's book, Lama Alan's book, that he is very, very keen on William James. William James was a 19th century philosopher, psychologist, a very leading thinker. And he was very clear. He said, geniuses of all kinds have one thing in common, and that is the capacity for sustained voluntary attention. Sustained voluntary attention. He went on to say that our perception of reality is very much tied closely to where we focus our attention. We tend to think reality is out there and, you know, everybody can see reality. This isn't true. And even William James, this is not true. It's where we focus our attention. And he went on to say, for the moment, whatever we attend to is reality. So this idea of attention is very important. It's not so much what's out there that's real. It's what we choose to focus on that's real. What comes out of all this is quite clearly attention is extremely selective, extremely selective. So the more that we can develop that, the more control we have of our own learning. You have a mind that's sharp. You can put that anywhere and you will be able to develop and delve deeply into that nature. It's good to have teachers. It's good to have all these things. But how much better if you have the confidence to do it yourself? Confidence and technique. Learn the techniques. Your confidence comes. The other thing I think to understand about shamatha is that shamatha is not a Buddhist practice. This was going on in India, Tibet, all through the East for centuries before the Buddha. In fact, shamatha really and truly in and of itself is very morally neutral. So how does it become a Buddhist practice? It becomes a Buddhist practice through motivation of bodhicitta. That heart of all the Mahayana. It is the Mahayana. It's the individual, the mind that wants to become enlightened in order to benefit all sentient beings without exception. With that motivation, practicing shamatha becomes a Buddhist practice. And so whenever you are learning, whenever you're practicing shamatha, if you're coming from a Buddhist perspective, a Mahayana perspective, then always your motivation is bodhicitta, and you practice bodhicitta meditations to keep the mind open, to keep the mind ready always to benefit every sentient being. Practicing shamatha, my teacher Lama Zopa says, without bodhicitta, he says in many lifetimes, people have developed shamatha, many lifetimes, but they're still here. They're still suffering. So he says, okay, it's good, but unless you have the bodhicitta motivation, what's the point? When I wrote to Rinpoche expressing my desire to do a long retreat on shamatha years ago, the reply was typically Lama Zopa, and told me that's fine, good, glad, but you must remember bodhicitta. Make bodhicitta part of your practice every day. Think with bodhicitta, sleep with bodhicitta, wake up with bodhicitta, and practice with bodhicitta. That was his advice. Where does shamatha come in all of the Buddhist teachings? Well, it's very firmly rooted in the Lamrim, and it's firmly rooted in the Great Scope. Now, shamatha is very useful in the initial scope and in the medium scope, but it's absolutely essential in the Great Scope. Sitting in the Great Scope of Lamrim is bodhicitta, emptiness, the nature of reality, and shamatha. It's rooted there, and it's rooted there because no bodhicitta, no wisdom of reality without shamatha. Shamatha is essential. It's very beneficial in the first two scopes. It will help everything, but it's essential in the third scope. So how can we summarize all that? We summarize that by saying that all realizations within Dharma depend on shamatha. Yeah, all realizations. The mind that tries to focus on any of the topics of Dharma without training will continually oscillate between agitation and dullness, restlessness and boredom. And so the cultivation of stability of attention is a core technique, What they're looking at here is our ability to focus for hours on end on a chosen object. That's very simple. Very simply said. Now, when you're doing this, you need to have confidence in not just your object that you've chosen, but where you are on the path. So what we're going to do now is look at a structure which is in Lama Allen's book, in depth in the appendix, in brief in page 6. And there is a handout that you can download. And I'd like to look at that now. If you've downloaded it, it looks something like this. Okay. And if you've not and you've got the book, then it's, like I say, it's on page 6, or it's in the appendix. Do you have that? Do people have that? Great, excellent, excellent, good, good. So what we're looking at here, we're looking at, as it says here, the 9 steps to attentional balance. This was Kamala Shila's approach. It was his way of saying, here's how you develop sustained attention in order to penetrate the nature of reality. Here's how you do it. Here's the structure. Here's the structure. Now, as we look at this structure, when we think of agitation and dullness, we tend to think of one thing. Okay, this is agitation and this is dullness. However, when you're dealing with the mind, it's more refined than that. And so let's take agitation, although it's the same for dullness. Take agitation. When you have agitation, as you develop shamatha, you're dealing with different levels of agitation. Initially, you'll be dealing with very coarse levels of agitation. Once you've dealt with the coarse levels of agitation, you're dealing with medium levels of agitation. And when you've dealt with that, you're dealing with subtle levels of agitation. And it's the same with dullness. There's coarse dullness, medium dullness, and subtle dullness. Okay, so there's different levels that you'll be dealing with. It's a bit like this. I sit here and there's a lot of gardening going on here with lots of cutting down of hedges, very noisy. So imagine that you're trying to do some meditation and the noise outside is all about people mowing the lawn, cutting down hedges. It's very gross, right? And if somebody says to you, why can't you concentrate? And you'll say, look at that noise. How could anybody concentrate with this noise, right? This is like coarse agitation. Now, let's say in the afternoon, they all go off for their tea. They have a nice lunch. No more cutting the grass, no more hedges, but there's still noise. And the noise is like passing traffic, right? And you think to yourself, how can anyone meditate with all this noise of traffic? You never noticed the traffic before, right? Never noticed it. That's like medium agitation. Now let's say the traffic stops for a while. You're trying to meditate and all you hear is birds. That's all you hear here, birds. And you say, how can I meditate? Have you heard those birds? That's like subtle. That's like subtle agitation. When you have gross noise, you don't even notice the cars. You don't notice the birds. This is the same with this agitation. You deal with the gross. When you've dealt with the gross, you identify and deal with the medium agitation. When you've dealt with that, you recognize and deal with the subtle. And that's the same for dullness. Dullness itself is coarse, medium, and subtle. So that's something to keep in mind. That's quite important. The progress through each of the stages that we will go through today and later on is really about, I mean, if you wanted to make it very simple, it really is about achieving each stage by progressively rooting out more and more agitation and dullness. It's really what it's about. All the 9 stages is about rooting out progressively more subtle forms of agitation and dullness. That's really what it's about. Any questions so far? I know it's not really a good thing for a teacher to say any questions, because what happens is you get this blank. But I'm not sure. If you want to raise your, if you have a question to clarify any of that so far, because the actual meditations are not that complicated. It's this stuff that you need to get into to get the right technique. So anything I can clear up so far? Jenny?
Clue. It's not so much clearing up, but it's just the examples that you've just given have been from exterior
Yes.
distraction, agitation. And I'm sure many here, like myself, will find that a lot of the agitation is internal.
Always.
So
Yeah.
is that
No,
coming up?
you're right, but it's hard to give an internal one because everybody will be different. I'm just,
Different.
it's when I first started, it was like, well, how do I know? You know, I mean, why is it that I can't identify? I mean, I'm getting taught, this is what I thought, I'm getting taught about coarse, subtle, coarse, medium, and how come I can't recognize all of that? How come I have to spend all this time here? And I couldn't quite get it. And it was the only way I could get it personally was to make it external and have a good look at it. That was what I did. So really, I'm giving that not so much for external noise, but to recognize what's happening internally. Yeah, it's very hard to do this because in the end, no one can look into your mind and go, oh yeah, you've achieved stage four. Oh, well done. You know, nobody can do that. You know, you really are progressing well. Who can do that? You do that. And the only way you can do that really is to know this bit first. But to give an example internally, not sure I could do that. But if you can think of this external thing and apply it to the noise that's happening in your mind, or the dullness that's happening in your mind, then you can say, okay, I can see now why I have to start with the coarse levels. Thanks, Jenny. Thanks for clearing that up. That's brilliant. Thanks. Anyone else? Stella?
Hello. I wanted to ask you, I found that useful, the mowing the traffic and the birds. But I wondered, do you have a similar analogy for dullness, please?
I never had problem with dullness because my mind is always dull, so I never really thought about that too much. Certainly, I tend to. Once I understood that it wasn't sleepiness, and it's often translated as sleepiness, but I don't know if it helps you. It doesn't help me. Sleepiness doesn't help me. I know what sleeping is, but dullness to me is very much like boredom. This is how I feel. And so there's times when I'm a little bit bored, there's times when I'm really bored, and there's times when I'm kind of like this. So dullness to me, for me, is like a mental boredom. I'm either very bored, help, I'm kind of medium, or not too bad, but kind of drift off. So I'm not sure I can really. That's how I worked it anyway.
Thank you. That's helpful. Thank
That
you.
okay?
Yes, thank you.
It's just the way I do. It's just the way I do. You have to make all of this meaningful to you, really
Yes.
meaningful to you.
Thank you.
Analogies are all very well, but if they don't speak to you, waste of time. Thank you, Stella. Anyone else? Okay. All right, so let's look at these first two levels, just the first two levels here. So these are the nine steps for attentional development. So the first step is called directed attention. Directed attention. What you're looking at here, directed attention, this is saying if, let's give you a framework of 24 minutes. All the great teachers of the past have recommended, Padmasambhava definitely recommends this, and other teachers, that when you're starting these type of meditations, don't start with long sessions or too short. And their idea was 24 minutes to start with, 24 minutes, right? A 60th of a day. I'm not sure why it's a 60th of a day, but they let you know it's 60th of a day. So let's say you're doing a 24-minute session. The first 20 minutes could be just getting into the zone, right? But in that 24 minutes, if you have a few seconds where you're focusing on your chosen object without agitation or dullness, you're actually focusing, then you've achieved stage one. Now, having said that, not if you do it once, but if you consistently do it time and time again, where for a few seconds, even within a 24-minute session, you're able to focus on your chosen object, then you've achieved stage one. Amazing. I mean, it's just, I remember the first teachings I had this, I was with Wendy, with Alan Wallace in London, and we were looking at each other going, ooh. It was absolutely mind-blowing. Because I went from, I can't do this, I'll never be able to do this, I can't visualize, to, oh my God, I think I've got stage one. It wasn't true, but I thought it was. At least it was some sort of progress. So is that clear? Within a 24-minute session, if in that 24 minutes you occasionally are able to focus without agitation or dullness on your chosen object for a few seconds, and that happens kind of consistently, then you've achieved stage one. How do you achieve stage one? And the way it's laid out in Alan's book, it talks about what power is it within you that helps you achieve that? And that becomes quite clear. It's learning the instructions. Learn the instructions. Do not read the instructions. Do not listen to someone telling you about the instructions. Learn the instructions. That's your power. There's still problems, of course, because you have no continuity here. You have no continuity. The biggest imbalance in your mind is still coarse excitation. Still coarse excitation. The analogy that Alan uses, for those of us that are old enough who can remember tuning into stations, I mean, radio stations now are kind of preset, right? But what he says is, like, if you're tuning in to a radio station, you're trying to find a radio station, but there's all this noise and scatter and you're never quite getting it, never quite getting it, then you haven't got any form of shamatha. But in this trying to find your station, the analogy is trying to find your object. For a few seconds, you find that station. There's still a lot of noise, but you're finding it. And you're focused and you're able to hold that for a few seconds, then you lose it. Then you find it again. This is the analogy he uses. So this is not a perfect, pristine noticing. No, within 24 minutes, a few times, you're able to hold that object for a few seconds without agitation or dullness. Then you have stage one. And you do that consistently for a while. You have stage one. Not to be sneezed at. Not to be sneezed at. How do you develop it? What type of power? Through the power of learning the instructions. Learning the instructions. You still have coarse excitation, but still. So if you look at stage two, so if somebody says to you, how do you know now that I've achieved stage one? People can't look in your mind and tell you. You tell yourself because you know the instructions. You know what you've achieved. You know. You can check, of course, but you know. So let's look at stage two. Now, stage two is called continuous attention. I don't know why it's called that, because it's got nothing to do with continuous attention, really. It's not continuous. It's not as it sounds. So what you're looking at here is in the tuning of your mind to trying to focus within a 24 minutes, you are able to hold that object, focus your attention without too much agitation, too much dullness. And you can do that for a minute. And that you're able to do that consistently, then you have achieved stage two. This is a huge step forward. I must say, I never noticed much difference after stage, but stage two, the benefit of stage two begins to show up in everything you meditate on. Everything you meditate on starts to become clearer, more focused, just stage two. And what does it say? That within a 24 minutes consistently, you have at least a minute where you're focusing on the object without too much agitation, too much dullness. Now, the way it's outlined in Lama Alan's book is he said, what power is this? And the power is thinking about the practice. So you're going beyond memorizing, learning the instructions. Now you're going beyond that. You're actually continuously thinking about the practice, by continuously placing your mind on the practice, when you start to sit down and do this, then the achievement of stage two is well within your grasp, well within your grasp. And this can be done, Lama Alan said, really, you know, doing short sessions every day, even at home. And the benefit is absolutely incalculable on everything you do, on everything you do. I'm only doing the first two stages at the moment. Any questions about the first two stages? Yes, Tahila, hello.
Venerable Mary, thank you for the teaching. I have a question. For beginners who cannot sit for 24 minutes, what would be your suggestion?
I think for everybody, you do what you can. You do what you can. You have to start from where you are. You really do. You just have to start from where you are. Sometimes when people give instructions like this, it can put people off because they think, I can't sit for 24 minutes. Sorry, can't do it. But when we start meditating, you'll see what I mean. When you first start this practice, you're not 24 minutes focusing on the object. You're not. You're learning how to relax. Within a 24-minute session, you're learning how to relax. You're learning how to become stable. You're learning how to become vivid. You're learning about being still. You're learning about being vigilant. Now, for many people, that can take up a lot of your 24 minutes. It can. And sometimes you're only a few minutes. In the beginning, it's only a few minutes focusing on the object. Now, I'm not saying that's the way to go. I'm saying that's the reality of people who are practicing. As time goes on, you become so familiar what it's like to be relaxed. If you think you know what it's like to be relaxed now, this is nothing compared to the relaxation we need for shamatha. Once you've got a mental picture of that, and you've got a mental taste of what it's like to be stable and vivid, then the time between, you know, you start spending less time on that aspect and more time on focusing on the object. And really, I mean, I've met practitioners who within 3 or 4 breaths have got the right depth of relaxation, have got the right stability, and got the right vividness. Can I say that's not me? Just say that now. That's not me. But many practitioners who have practiced this a long time, for sure. So if you can sit for 24 minutes in a very, very relaxed, of course, I'll go into that, then go for it. But if you can't, then you take all these instructions and you look at where you are and you adjust them to suit yourself. We have to start from where we are. So 24 minutes for monks. This is all written for monks by monks in Tibet, right? So no problem relaxing. No problem sitting for 24 minutes. For all of us, maybe a bit more difficult. I was never one of nature's meditators. I'll say that to you now. Anybody that knows me knows that understanding stuff, learning stuff, analytical meditation, I'm your girl. Shamatha, so I know how difficult it is for many people. Yeah. I'm hoping you're all better than I was, I'll tell you. Is that okay, Taylor? Okay. Anyone else? No? Okay. Okay. So it's clear, isn't it, that when you're developing shamatha on the 9 stages, the 10th being shamatha, there are very clear landmarks. If you learn the instructor, very clear landmarks all the way through to tell you where you are. And these landmarks become very important for your confidence in the practice. Because no one can look into your mind and say, yes, you're here, there, or there. You have to decide yourself. So this is what gives you confidence. You know where you are, you know what to do, you know what to look out for. all the stages, I'll say again, is going from not being able to focus at all. You're trying to tune in and just getting nowhere. You're starting there and you're going all the way through to sustained attention, sustained focus for hours on end without any problems. That's the trajectory. When Lama Alim was learning this himself from His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and when he was practicing shamatha, he said that some of the clearest things that he was taught and to understand is that success or failure in shamatha practice depends on three things. The ability to relax. Now, the relaxation we did at the beginning of this session, that's not enough, okay? Up that by 100 times at least. Deep relaxation is necessary. The ability to relax, the ability to stabilize your attention, and for that attention on the object to be vivid. So these three things become a mantra for people developing shamatha: relaxation, stability of attention, and vividness. Much better spending time on getting this right than spending a lot of time not focusing on the object. Get this right. Now, for relaxation, stability, and vividness, in turn, needs more relaxation. You can never relax enough. And a stillness. You have to develop a stillness of body, not a tight stillness, but just a stillness of body and a stillness of mind. And you really need to be vigilant in what you're doing. So what is the teaching saying? It's saying success or failure depends on the ability to relax, be stable, and be vivid. This in turn needs even deeper relaxation, a stillness of body and mind, and vigilance. So this is what we're going to be working on today. Success or failure depends on this. This is really getting the mind ready for all of this. Initially, relaxation is crucial. Relaxation is crucial. And it's said that most failure, and what puts people off, because they can't do what they set out to do, they think it's some sort of complicated, esoteric thing they're doing wrong. No, it's your inability to relax. So if you do that, then you need to say to yourself, well, how, when I'm doing this meditation, what's my position to be? What position do I put my body in? So you remember that the Buddha taught four positions for meditation: sitting, standing, walking, and lying down, the supine position. For shamatha, what is highly recommended for centuries is the sitting position and the supine position. These two are very, it's not saying that walking and standing meditations are not good, but in your meditation session, it is sitting and the supine. Is the best to develop shamatha. And so Lama Alim spends a lot of time teaching people how to relax and settle the body in its natural state, imbued with the three qualities of relaxation, stillness, vigilance, relaxation, stability, vividness, these things. So if you're sitting, then to develop shamatha, so you're not looking at tantra here. So if you can sit cross-legged or half cross-legged, then that's very good. It's not necessary. Sitting on a chair, sitting comfortably. The most important thing that the texts say and Lama emphasizes is to keep the back reasonably, not ramrod stiff, but reasonably straight. The back of the head to be tall, the chin slightly down. So these type of positions that you've heard about many times. So sitting in a chair comfortably with both feet on the floor, that's reasonable. That's reasonable. If you're comfortable sitting in a cross-legged or semi-cross-legged position, then of course that's also very good. But don't be put off by this if you can't sit cross-legged. The second position, which he highly emphasizes, in fact, what he says, if you're doing any retreat on this, practice both of these. Even if you're good at sitting, practice the supine position, the corpse position. Vary it so that you become expert in the corpse position and you become expert in the sitting position, because there'll come a time when you're not able to sit. There'll come a time when your mind is so agitated that it will be beneficial for you to go into the supine position. So learning both, crucial. So the supine position, of course, if you Google this and you go into YouTube, it's very clear. What you're looking at is lying flat on a comfortable surface. Your legs are straight out. Your feet going out to the side, let it fall to the outside. The arms about 30 degrees from your body, but with the palms upwards. And when you're lying like that, if you need to put a pillow behind your head or a pillow underneath your knees, that's fine. And then just look up, as you're lying there, look up slightly and mentally draw a straight line from between your ankles up to your navel and up to your chin. To correct any crookedness of the body. If you know a yoga teacher, then you can ask, that would be wonderful. Or if you're into yoga, this is a corpse position is one of their standards. So if you know a good yoga teacher, they could help you with this, or go online. It's fairly clear. But it's always good for someone to help you with this, just initially. So sitting. Most important, keeping the back reasonably straight. The head in the right position. So there's a tendency for some people to go upwards. Okay. And there's a tendency for heads to go downwards. Heads going, if you notice your head going upwards too much in this, it tends to be a kind of agitation, you know. It's good to be vigilant here. The head going down, it's got a lot to do with sleepiness, dullness. So keeping that. Your eyes, it's the texts say, and Lama Alan says, that really you can have your eyes in any way that you like, really open or closed or half closed. When this changes, I'll point it out to you. But for most of this, you can have your eyes whichever way you find comfortable. Whichever way you find comfortable. The traditional way is to have the eyes half closed with the gaze just soft. And gazing downwards, from the tip of your nose downwards. You're not focusing on anything, you've just got your eyes half open, gazing down. But if you're happier at this stage with your eyes being closed or fully open, then that's not a problem. So, any questions about that? So no need to contort yourself. Whatever makes you comfortable, it is your ability to relax that's going to start you off on this. So having cushions around, blankets around, padding yourself here or there. If you've got arthritis like me, I'm well padded, me. So anything you need to make it comfortable. If you're not relaxed, you're not comfortable, very little progress. The first time I heard that you could actually achieve the whole of shamatha in the supine position, it was like, sign me up. Yeah, I'll have that. Thank you. How kind. And it's okay if I sit in a chair. Nobody, no, that's fine. Gosh, okay. I mean, the cross-legged, the full cross-legged, full vajra position is really so beneficial in all meditation, but it becomes highly crucial in tantra. Highly crucial in tantra. But apart from that, to develop shamatha, not necessary. So any questions I can clear up about that? All very accepting. Okay, it seems reasonable, no? Okay, so what I'd like to do now, did somebody say something?
Sarah's got a question.
Who?
Sarah.
Sarah, where are you, dear?
Can I Hello.
Oh, hi, Sarah.
Hi. I was wondering, because obviously you said a supine position lying on your back. If you can keep your back, if you can keep your spine straight in a side lying position, is that an option, or is it the teaching say that it's better to be on the back, your back?
On your back, yeah.
On your back, yeah.
But it's okay. Like it's like everything else. I remember Lama Allen being at some of the 2-month retreats I did with Lama Allen, people saying, because it comes this time when you're practicing this before you go to sleep. I mean, many people practice this before they go to sleep and they just can't do it on their back. And he said, well, it's best on your back, but if you have to do it on the side, you have to do it on the side. There's an optimum thing for everything. So when you're looking at supine, you really are looking at supine. Okay. It's worth practicing it. Lama Allen calls this the recovery position. The supine position, it's not just good for shamatha. It's good for overall physical and mental health. If you can relax well in the supine position, they say it even starts to unravel the knots in your psychic channels. It's so beneficial. It's not like lying down to go to sleep. You really have to do this properly, but if you do it properly, the benefits are huge. It is worth practicing that. When I one of the first retreats I did with Lama Allen, you had to practice each of these three objects, the breath, mind and its contents, and awareness. You had to practice that in the two positions, sitting and lying down, right? So by the time we did this, and we used to meet up with him once a week, and 1 week I went to him and we were on awareness, and I said to him, really not the way to approach a teacher. I said, look, I've been practicing this and I can't do it with awareness. I'm fine lying down, sitting up with breath and with mind and its contents. But if I lie down and do awareness, I fall asleep. So I think I'll just give that a miss. This was not the right thing to say. And so I then got this 10-minute tirade of, oh, you think you're always going to be able to sit up, do you? You think you're never going to get sick? You're never going to get ill? You're never going to die? You think when you're dying, people are going to come and prop you up all the time? Do you think you're never going to be in a position where you have to recover your health and your strength by lying down? Are you going to decide just not to do shamatha because I had to listen 10 minutes of this, right? So the takeaway from all of this was learn the practice. Now, it took me longer than most people, but I eventually got the hang of it. But it wasn't easy. It really wasn't easy. If I laid down and I tried to do the awareness, I would just the dullness was out of this world. But with practice, as the great Shanti Devi said, there is nothing that you can't get better with practice. You just do. And on retreat, there was nothing else to do, so that's what we did. So my advice would be keep practicing that, but in the end, you do what you can do. Yeah.
Right. Thank you.
I personally think that once you get the hang of this, you could do this standing on your head if you were so inclined. Mm. To help you get there, probably best to do the back.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks, Sarah. Anyone else? Nope. Okay. So let's do some meditation. Let's see what we mean by relaxation and stability. So get yourself, just take a minute or so to get yourself in a comfortable position. If you need to pad yourself out, get a blanket. If you want to lie down in a supine position, that is fantastic, no problem. Being comfortable. And just gently check your posture. As you're settling into your posture, check it. If you're in the supine position, just check you've got your head and your arms, your hands in the right position, your legs are straight. Mentally draw that line between your ankles to your navel, to your to your chin, make sure it's straight. Your eyes are comfortable. Open, closed, half open. Breathing evenly and gently. Drawing the mind inward. Becoming interested in how your whole body is responding to each in-breath and out-breath. Now, allow your consciousness to sink down through your body. So start to lower your consciousness, becoming aware of lower and lower parts of your body. And as your consciousness sinks down, deeply relax the body on the out-breath. Just relax. Every out-breath, relaxing. Becoming aware of where your body contacts the earth, the chair, the carpet, where it's contacting earth elements. Become aware of that. And also aware of where one part of your body is touching another part of your body. On the in-breath, allow awareness to emerge and flow through your body and enjoy it. On the in-breath, allow awareness to emerge and flow through your body. You can pay some attention to that in-breath. Let your belly fill first, then the diaphragm moves, and then the chest fills, and then release. Belly, diaphragm, chest, release. And gently scan now the body. Release any tension, especially in the face and the brow. Continue to breathe and release that tension on the out-breath. Your attitude now is of ease and vigilance. If you're sitting, you can increase your vigilance by slightly lifting your sternum. Just a slight lift of the sternum will increase your vigilance. If you're lying down in the supine, just mentally say to yourself, this is a formal meditation, not rest. That will increase your vigilance. See if you can taste the difference between ease and vigilance. Begin to note the tactile sensations. Don't rush this part. Note the tactile sensations of the feet and then slowly move up, noting all the sensations within the body from the feet up to the crown, and then release on the out-breath. Avoid all movement now if you can, not tensely. Noting the tactile sensations of the feet up to the crown, releasing on the out-breath. Avoid all movement. Take an initial breath. So be very, very focused on this breath. Breathing, filling the belly, movement of the diaphragm, filling the chest. And then actively release and relax. Just take that initial breath in your own time. In a moment, just take three breaths, breathing in through the nostrils, and as you breathe in, let awareness penetrate your entire body, again noticing the sensations related to the respirations. So three times, breathing in through the nostrils, letting awareness permeate your entire body, and note the sensations. Now, allow your respirations to flow naturally. Don't impose any rhythm. Don't influence your breath. Have no preferences. Just allow your respirations to flow naturally. As your breath flows naturally, just note the sensations of the respirations in the body, wherever they arise. But now, when you're observing the sensations, try to notice the full in and out breath. From the beginning, the middle and end of the breath. Stay with it. Be aware, without giving it any energy, simple awareness, if the breath is long or short, deep or shallow, slow or fast. You don't have to talk to yourself about this. It's some sort of field awareness of the type of breath. It's as if your body is fast asleep, but the mind is highly vigilant. That's what we're aiming for, a body that is almost asleep and a mind that's bright and vigilant. When thoughts or ideas or emotions arise, no problem. Just let them go, relax and release them with each out-breath. No other antidotes. Notice the thought, let it go, relaxing and releasing on the out-breath. It's enough. Again and again, counteract any difficulty by relaxing more deeply on the out-breath. And then allow the in-breath to flow into you effortlessly, like an incoming tide. Any problem, relax more deeply on the out-breath. But try not to effortlessly, with effort, breathe in. Just allow the breath to flow naturally into you like an incoming tide, again and again. Try to mentally note the level of relaxation you've achieved. What does it feel like? Now try to maintain that and shift your focus now to the rise and fall of the abdomen with the breath. Now we're increasing our stability. Change your focus now to the rise and fall, the expansion and contraction of the abdomen with the breath. note the full sensation of the rise and fall of the abdomen with the breath, the beginning, the middle, the end, any pauses. There is a tendency at this stage to have mental images of the rise and fall of the abdomen. This is discouraged. Refocus on the sensation alone. Keep your mind here, the rise and fall of the abdomen, noting the full sensation for the rest of the session. 8 minutes only. Try. if you need to, arouse your attention and refocus for the last 3.5 minutes. Now, how many people are convinced that that was at least an hour? I promise you, 24 minutes. Yeah, yeah, 24 minutes. Any comments anyone would like to make? Any statements? Sometimes better just to sit with it. I know, sometimes. The thing about the relaxation is try to get into your mind that this word relaxation in relation to shamatha is not a patch on any type of relaxation you've had so far, okay? Try to understand. Don't get mistaken with the word. I'm relaxed. I'm like, no. Understand that you really have to go quite deep with this relaxation. If you've ever been in a state where you're falling asleep and your body, your mind is still a bit active, but your body is like out, it's like that. The body is almost asleep, but the mind very active. That's really what you're aiming for. The ability, the stability of body and mind really does come through time and practice. It really does come through time and practice. And when you first get a taste of stability, that will increase. That will increase. And then you become quite stable, but it does need practice. During a session, you might only gain stability for a few seconds, not to worry. If you've achieved it for a few seconds, you can achieve it for a few minutes. If you can achieve it for a few minutes, the world's your oyster. So it's only practice. It's only practice. This kind of stability, once you've got it, you can then transpose it to when in walking meditation. And it's very helpful with walking meditation if you can get this type of stability. One of the difficulties with gaining stability is the mental images that come up of the lungs expanding and contracting, of the abdomen going up and down. This is just normal. This is what, because we're all very visual, we tend to focus on that. And that is highly discouraged. It is discouraged. What you're really focusing on is the sensation of it. And in the beginning, that can be difficult. That can be difficult to separate the kind of mental image that comes up. Again, no problem. You just keep practicing and that you can overcome that. Remember, Shantideva, everything can be overcome with practice. That's not a problem. I made a note for... In the break that's coming up now, in the break, it's 2 hours, and I'm sure you've got lots and lots to do, so that's fair enough. But if you could place your mind just a couple of times, if you've got a mindfulness bell, I would set it for like every half hour or every 20 minutes. When that bell rings, just remember the instructions. Remember what you can of the instructions. Don't be put off if you think, what did she say? Don't worry about that. Don't worry about that. The bell rings or you remember. Just try to think, what were those instructions? What were they? And then also when you finish that, try to place your mind on the practice itself. Why do I want to do this? What's the benefit? So you have a break. But breaks are more important often than the actual practice. You have more time outside the break. So if you can a few times, a bell helps, is try to place your mind on the instructions. Try, even if you can't remember them, still delve into it. Try to find out just a couple of times. And try to put your mind a couple of times in the break on why you're doing this. Yeah. Okay. And maybe we can, not do a formal dedication, but maybe now we're going for a break, so maybe we're just making our mind this kind of dedication of what we've done so far and kind of looking forward to the afternoon and maybe saying to yourself, I will remember these instructions at least twice during this break. I will think about this practice at least twice during this break. So thank you very much for putting up with me this morning. That's brilliant. Thank you all for turning up and putting up with me. And I'll see you all at 2 o'clock.